If anyone has any questions, please feel free to move to the microphones. I'll call on you. I thought we might have a little case to let the experts enlighten us on. As a reminder, and thank you to all our speakers. All those talks were great. We'll start here at the front mic.
Hi, Mark Hamill from Roanoke, Virginia. Great presentation from everyone. Two questions, one regarding ECMO and one regarding the fluid resuscitation. In terms of fluid resuscitation, with pre-hospital fluid resuscitation, apparently the FDA has approved a product for military use, a lyophilized plasma. Do you see that making its way into the field relatively quickly? I mean, I know right now it's only approved for military use in austere environments, but where do you see that going? And regarding ECMO, at our institution, our cardiothoracic surgeons have a lock on ECMO, and that leads to some very interesting decisions sometimes about who's a candidate and who's not. Do you see products like the pumpless systems like Novalung or anything like that? Do you have any familiarity with them? I don't know where the trials are right now, but can you comment on that at all?
In terms of the new products in the pre-hospital setting, I know there's ongoing discussion. I don't know how far along in terms of clinical trials for that. I thought that the plasma pre-hospital use was sort of a very compelling data, very exciting data for the severely injured and maybe in hemorrhagic shock patients. So we at our institution, we're actually starting the discussion about the pre-hospital use of the plasma, but there are obviously some logistic issues with that as well. So
I think that there's a culture change with ECMO as it's becoming more mainstream. I think a lot of places, the legacy has been within cardiothoracic surgery, and they do provide a great service, but I think that those times are changing. And this is really going to become part of the domain of critical care, regardless of the subspecialty. So I think that will just evolve over time. We even went through the same growing pains in our own institution. And it was ultimately through a multidisciplinary, sort of collaborative approach that we really tried to change the culture, and we're still working at it. As far as the pumpless systems, the Novalung has sort of fallen out of favor. A-Lung is now developing a new device. There are other devices coming onto the market, some which are pumpless, but the safety profile of the centrifugal system is probably going to become the standard. And quite honestly, I think the vision forward is I think ECMO is going to become like CRRT and some other devices. It's just going to become standard critical care.
Front mic.
Sata from Lehi Clinic. Can we have visual, since we lost the visuals during Dr. Zoni's presentation, can we have that, and can we have the reference for the how to start an ECMO that you mentioned in your talk? And my question is that I agree with you that ECMO, with improved technology and with much better training of the ICU nurses, they will be accustomed to it like they are now with the CRRT. It's very easy to do continuous renal replacement, and we can do continuous lung replacement. What do you think is the best and least complicated avenue for the ECMO? Is it the veno-venous, or is the arterial more effective?
Well, I think it depends on the indication. I think that there's veno-venous is certainly technically easier. It's a lot more intuitive, I think, for the end user. And we've even found for patients who traditionally develop, say, septic shock, and we thought we needed cardiac support, so VA ECMO, we find that if you actually put them on early VV ECMO and just provide better oxygenation, that you actually can reverse some of that sepsis. So I think that the field is still evolving, and I wasn't able to show, but we're sort of in this golden age where I think it's finally here. There's some sticking power to it, but we're still trying to define the right patients and the optimal timing.
And can we have the reference for that?
Yes, it's in the AJRCC, that's the Pulmonary Blue Journal, but I can get you the reference.
Okay. Thank you all. I'm Derek Collier from Nashville. I want to ask Dr. Zonis about the ECMO and the timing to preferred referral. The reason I ask, I do full-time locums, and I'm sometimes in Ditchwich General Hospital. starting a program, and I've been asked, what is APRV by a respiratory therapist? And do you prefer to get those referrals when the diagnosis of ARDS is made or when the patient is showing signs of failure?
It's a great question. We always prefer early consultation, and the reality is that 60% of those patients don't need ECMO. I think the benefit of having that phone call is sometimes just some friendly advice, some expert advice, and oftentimes those patients can be turned around just with a sort of a second set of eyes looking at the patient. About 40% ultimately go on to require that support, but I think that's the advantage. And really my take on it is, I don't want anybody on ECMO. You know, this is the rescue mode, but the earlier the call, the better. What we really don't like is when there's a missed opportunity. We get called 8-9 days later from the medical ICU where they've just been flogging the patient, you know, trying to do the best they can, but it hadn't occurred to them. Now we're seeing now that our program has been up and running, we get those calls a lot earlier.
Is there a question at the other mic?
Yes, hi. Christina Burmes from Mesa, Arizona. Sort of related to that, I'm in an institution that does proning, but not ECMO. How long do you suggest that we give a patient a try on proning before we think about calling an ECMO center?
So, great question. I certainly think, and that's even part of our algorithm, is we will prone first before considering 24 hours. I think if you're going to see it in that first 16 to 24 hours, you'll see which trajectory the patient's going to go. And if they were making marginal improvements, we'll hold off and we just kind of keep them on the radar. And certainly there's some pretty good data that supports the combination of proning and ECMO support. It's very, very feasible. But I think if you're thinking about proning a patient, that's probably the time to pick up the phone and call, at least to alert everyone.
Thank you.
To help guide a little discussion, why don't we talk through this? 24 Crohn's, 25-pound weight loss, poorly controlled on steroids, has now done 3 weeks of combined immunotherapy. Comes to the ED, perforated septic shock, gets a resection, significant contamination, endileostomy, mucous fistula, is in the ICU, still in septic shock with ARDS. So Dr. Sawyer, does this patient get steroids, vitamin C, thiamine, a beta blocker? How are we going to bring this one into the ICU?
The first thing I want to know is what level of vasoactive agents they're on. So if they're on high amounts of vasoactive agents, then yes. In terms of steroids, you have to be very careful, of course, and go through their history. And anybody who has a history of steroids any time in the past year pretty much automatically go on steroids, because it's hard in this situation to figure out whether they have any insufficiency. So I would definitely do steroids. I would probably give vitamin C if it was easily available, and fludrocortisone. And I did not talk about thiamine. I'm actually a big fan of thiamine, and I'd probably give thiamine as well.
Go ahead, Dr. Green.
Yeah, definitely vitamin C, thiamine, the steroids, starting off the steroids. It looks like that chest x-ray is pretty significantly fluffed out, so I would get them proned early. I think the data really supports us proning early, and we often wait a little too late, so I would get them proned early. And just check, because it says significant blood loss, to make sure they've been appropriately resuscitated. I'd guide my volume therapy with my flow track monitor to try to assess for pulse pressure variation. And if there was difficulty with the low tidal volume ventilation, then paralytics will also be included into that algorithm.
Dr. Kuhn, this kid got 7 liters of normal saline during the operative case and has now landed in the ICU. What's your resuscitative strategy and fluid choice going to be?
Yeah, this is actually a great case to illustrate the point of how I'm old enough to think back maybe a couple of decades ago, where we just massively resuscitate these patients with fluids and fluids until you put bags in their skin to just collect the fluid out. I think in 2018 going forward, we ought to be very careful in terms of the type of fluid for this patient. Now, this is a profound septic shock patient. So I completely agree with Wendy in terms of getting more sort of targets for guiding my resuscitation, whether that's stroke volume variation, a constellation of both physiologic and biochemical parameters to kind of guide me with the resuscitation. But this is, you know, looking at the acid base, that is, if they receive 7 liters of presumably normal saline, they may have a compounded metabolic acidosis with the hypochloremia associated with that. So this is maybe a time to consider albumin in a septic shock patient like this, but you need additional parameters to guide your resuscitation. I think oligura is maybe a little too late to wait in terms of oliguria. So I get more data and consider use of albumin in this patient. I have a question for Dr. Sawyer in terms of the steroids. You know, there's usually a little bit of a confusion, residents or nursing staff, in terms of the dosing. Are you talking about the replacement, hydrocortisone replacement doses? Are you looking at higher doses of steroids for this patient?
So probably something between 200 and 300 milligrams a day of hydrocortisone. I'll usually use 100 Q8 or something like that, so not too much more than that. Can I ask Dr. Green a question? Okay, may I?
Certainly.
So you gave a great talk on nutrition and so forth, and most of the advice in terms of waiting to start parenteral nutrition is based off of data from studies where severely malnourished patients were not included. So here's a severely malnourished patient who's, let's say they're on high dose pressors and you don't think you can start enteral nutrition. When do you start TPN on somebody who is really badly malnourished? Does that alter what you think? Do you start it earlier or do you still wait the 5 to 7 days?
No, good question. Yeah, I will start the known malnourished as soon as is feasible to initiate it. I know they're malnourished, they're going to have a poor outcome, and with either this degree of contamination, I mean, there's going to be a certain deficit that's going to occur initially with protein losses, and they won't actually benefit as much from that nutrition as they're in this highly acute inflamed phase, but they will I will start it early so that I can get ahead of the eight ball.
Dr. Zonis, we've got a balanced resuscitation going. We've opted for early parenteral nutrition. We're using vitamin C and thiamine. I'm throwing my hands up. I've gone prone. I've done everything I can do. I'm calling in the cavalry. What's your decision making in VV versus VA, and what are the next steps for this patient?
Sure. So I'm not seeing any contraindications necessarily. Young person, to me this looks like probably a VV candidate. I mean, you could potentially make the argument because they've developed, if there are multiple pressors, but in this particular case, like I had just mentioned, I think if you just provide better oxygen support, you'll find that often you can dial down on the pressors and really reverse it. And I don't think you lose very much. You put in 2 venous cannulas, and if it doesn't work, then you just put in a 3rd cannula into the arterial system, and then you put them on, then you have them on full support. Someone like this, I mean, if they were really heading in the wrong direction, you know, I think if you prone them and you give them 16, 24 hours to try to turn around, then that's fine. Then if not, I don't think we lose much ground. But this is certainly someone that I would consider. The one thing that we often do, and I didn't mention this, is that we reflexively, in someone like this who has a known chronic condition, is that we always consult the palliative service for concurrent care, just to make certain that we are that we're providing the optimal care and that we're meeting the goals for this patient who may not be able to obviously participate, as well as their surrogate decision maker.
Super. Thank you to all our great speakers. Fantastic talks today. They'll be around to answer questions for a little bit longer. Thank you for coming.